Good morning. Thank you to AusPayNet and to John for the opportunity to open the batting this morning. This forum's always a highlight on the calendar, and I'm sure that that this year will be no exception. So not so long ago, opining on the future of the payment system might have been a pretty mundane affair. Not a great deal, a change from one year to the next. Not too many folks, perhaps other than a few diehards, were particularly interested. It's not the case today. For a start, our payment system is rapidly evolving. New innovations are springing up at a dizzying pace. And the payment system has never been more critical to the functioning of the Australian economy. Almost $300 billion in payments now settle across the RBA's central infrastructure every day. This is equivalent to Australia's annual GDP flowing through the payment system around every 10 days. And debates over the future of money and the future of payments are now regularly featuring in the public square. I'm discovering the public square very much extends to summer barbecue conversations. In some sense, money and technology have always been the subject of popular fascination, but this seems especially true today. And so to channel spirit of a former Prime Minister, one could say it's never been a more exciting time to be in payments. My remarks today will focus on the challenges and the opportunities in front of all of us involved in payments, and there's no shortage of both. Before diving in, let me briefly set the scene by highlighting where our payment system stands today and the RBA's role in it. The first point to make here is that Australia has a payment system we can be proud of. By global standards, it's fast, efficient, and reliable. It's also worth noting that for the better part of a couple of decades, retail merchant card payment costs have trended lower in Australia in response to increased transparency and competitive tension in the market. Some of this competitive tension has arisen organically, and some of it has been the result of intervention by the bank. And that brings me to the mandate of the RBA and to the Payment System Board. At the broadest level, this mandate is to help shape the payment system so that it works in the best interests of Australian households and Australian businesses. Our North Star is promoting the public interest. We strive to achieve this through a combination of suasion, regulation, and working with industry participants to help overcome some of the coordination issues that can sometimes bedevil payment systems internationally. We also recognise the key role of innovation in serving the public interest. One can think of the new payments platform as a notable example. More recently, the RBA materially raised the activity threshold beyond which security settlement facilities must comply with the financial stability standards. And as I'll discuss in a moment, we've also recently just launched a new project with industry to examine how central bank digital currency, stable coins, and tokenized bank deposits could support innovation and resilience in our wholesale asset markets. And where innovation promises to not only enhance efficiency, but also resilience and safety in our financial system, then all the better. This recognises that we are entering a new era for operational risk. It's a result of rising geopolitical tensions and other sources of potential disruption. And so for these reasons, strengthening resilience in our payment system and our key financial market infrastructures is a key area of focus for the bank and for the Council of Financial Regulators. This aside, the RBA is also working with the government to make sure that Australia's regulatory architecture is fit for purpose in the 21st century. This is a pressing issue given the foundational legislation setting out the bank's powers was drafted in another era. If there is one message to take away from my remarks today, it's this. While we should recognise that Australia has a world-class payment system today, it would be a mistake to assume the same will be true in 5 or 10 years' time without a concerted effort from everyone in this room and everyone across the ecosystem more generally. Now, of course, the RBA has a key role here, and we very much remain committed to working constructively with industry in promoting the public interest. But how industry responds to some of the challenges and opportunities I'll speak to today will ultimately determine whether the services that Australians will need and expect in the future will be delivered. So in the spirit of facing into challenges, let me begin with account-to-account payments. In her speech to this summit last year, the Governor spoke about industry's decision to target the decommissioning of the BECCS framework by 2030. The setting of a target date by industry has helped to focus attention right across the payments landscape, which is a good thing, but there's much to be done. While the share of account-to-account transfers made through the MPP has increased notably, BECCS is still the workhorse of the account-to-account payment system in Australia. And this includes payroll, pension and welfare payments that are critical to our fellow Australians. Given the importance of BECCS to our financial system, this year the Payment System Board asked the staff of the RBA to undertake a risk assessment of the intended decommissioning. In the course of engaging with a wide range of stakeholders, bank staff heard plenty of support for the migration to more modern payment rails like the MPP. There are features, for instance, of the MPP that many stakeholders find beneficial and value, including a 24/7 operation, real-time settlement and richer data capabilities. At the same time, some stakeholders have raised concerns about some aspects of the migration. I'll set these out in a moment, but my colleagues at the bank and on the Payment System Board see the central challenge as this. Industry is yet to arrive at a shared vision of the desired features of account-to-account payments in Australia. This is really a foundational issue. Establishing a common vision of the features that should underpin a desired end state will be essential if a program of this scale is to succeed. Once a consensus has emerged here, a roadmap with milestones can guide industry progress toward the ultimate objective. Now, let me share with you some of the feedback we've heard so far. First, there's been a sense that industry coordination, planning and certainty has probably not been where it should be. It's been insufficient, and there's been a lack of clarity, and this has made it difficult for industry participants to press on with their individual plans. Second, there's scope for the needs of end users to be given more prominence in industry discussions on the future of account-to-account payments. BECCS is the payment rail used to make the majority of essential payments to millions of Australians, so any replacement must be capable of reliably meeting end user needs. Third, a solution for the processing of bulk payments will be important. And the MPP and the Fast Settlement Service will need to have a capacity to handle a much higher volume of payments. Fourth, the cost of the transition and transaction costs in the future system have also been flagged as an issue for some stakeholders. Some end users who might not necessarily have requirements for all the advanced functionality of future systems understandably want options that represent value for money for them. And fifth, many stakeholders have expressed a desire for resilience to feature prominently in future account-to-account system arrangements. BECCS outages have typically been low, And so contingency arrangements in the future system will need to ensure that end user needs can continue to be met even when operational issues are experienced. And this really suggests that resilience is going to have to be built into the solution right from the outset. And finally, end users will be unable to move payments from BECCS until all customers can receive payments via an alternative channel. There's some banks using BECCS that are yet to connect to the MPP. And even for those that have done so, some of their BECCS reachable accounts are not currently reachable via the MPP. Now, it may well be that not all of these unreachable accounts will need transactional capabilities in the future, but this is something that institutions need to examine. So let me step back and offer a positive take on this feedback. It's been valuable for us in surfacing some issues that, if addressed appropriately, I think will give industry a very solid basis on which to move forward. The focus here on themes around resilience and functionality and end user needs is particularly relevant here. The announcement by industry of a target date of 2030 for BECCS decommissioning has already sparked some useful dialogue across the system. The challenge here now going forward is that all stakeholders are going to have a voice, and a broad consensus on some key issues is now essential if Australia's account-to-account payment system arrangements are going to be fit for purpose in the next decade. Time is now of the essence. Let me now turn to the review of retail payments regulation. As many of you will be aware, the bank recently launched a review of retail payments regulation. We had hoped to conduct a broad review of issues arising from new types of players, new types of technologies in digital payments. But as you know, proposed amendments to the PSLRA remain before the Australian Parliament. Given the limitations of our remit under the current PSLRA, it's important that these reforms are passed as soon as possible. For now, we're focused on whether there are further actions the RBA could take to put downward pressure on merchant card payment costs and on whether the surcharging framework remains fit for purpose. These issues can be dealt with under the PSLRA in its current form, and they're also inextricably linked. That is, merchants are less likely to surcharge if their payment costs are low. Given the shift toward electronic payments, card payment costs are an ongoing concern for merchants as they are for consumers. Keeping downward pressure on merchant fees for card payments, particularly for smaller merchants that tend to be charged higher fees, is an important priority for the bank and for the Payment System Board. And so we've asked for feedback on a range of issues. For instance, whether there's a case to change interchange regulation, whether further regulation could increase competitive pressure on scheme fees, whether further action is required to promote least cost routing for in-person transactions, and whether there are options to reduce complexity and improve transparency to better enable merchants to shop around for good deals. As the payments landscape has evolved significantly since the surcharging framework was introduced back in 2003, we think it's a good time to be reviewing whether the current rules are still achieving their intended purpose. Recognise here that there are arguments on both sides of this debate. It's a complex one, and we recognise also that some views are very strongly held. Let me stress that we are open to explore all options, all possible options, to find a position that will best serve the public interest. The arguments for retaining the current framework are as follows. First, it provides an important price signal to consumers to use a lower cost payment option. Second, merchants value the ability to surcharge to recover the cost of payment choices that are made by their customers. And third, surcharging rules have made a significant contribution to the long-run decline in average fees that merchants pay for card transactions. At the same time, reasonable concerns have also emerged about the current framework. In particular, fewer consumers are transacting with cash today and are therefore unable to avoid card surcharges. It's a very different environment in that respect to, say, 2003. Many small merchants are now on single rate plans that charge the same fee to merchants for accepting all types of cards. And the issue here is that this dulls the price signal to consumers and can mean that users of cheaper card payments are effectively subsidising users of more expensive cards. And consumers are sometimes unaware of the surcharge amount before paying. Now, we received over 70 submissions to our issues paper that closed last week. Many of those submissions came in from institutions that are represented here today. So we want to thank those of you who took the time to set out your views, and let me assure you they'll all be given very careful consideration. The process from here is that we will plan to publish those submissions on our website in January and to take a summary of the feedback you've provided to the Payment System Board at its first meeting in 2025, which will be in early March. Following this, we'll release a consultation paper setting out some potential policy actions around the middle of next year. And thereafter, a conclusions paper will set out the Payment Systems Board's final decisions, likely around the end of next year. Let me now turn to the topic of cross-border payments, another thorny one. Australian businesses and households that undertake international activities need efficient and safe ways to send and receive money. But cross-border payment services are still more expensive, they're more opaque, and they're slower than their domestic counterparts. Enhancing cross-border payments is therefore one of the Payment System Board's strategic priorities, and it's also an international commitment that Australia has made under the G20 roadmap. A recent review by the Financial Stability Board indicated that much more progress is needed to move toward the G20 roadmap cost targets. In Australia, we estimate that the average cost of sending $1,000 to other countries still significantly exceeds the relevant targets. However, the cost of sending money overseas from Australia can vary significantly across providers. For instance, banks are generally more expensive than non-bank providers, which in part reflects the size of the markups they tend to apply to the wholesale foreign exchange rate. By contrast, there are some non-bank digital providers that are offering prices that are around or actually a little below the G20 target levels. These differences highlight the importance of transparency over prices and of customers shopping around. The speed of cross-border payments is another area where more progress is needed. Bank intermediated cross-border transactions often take a day or more to reach the recipient. It reflects a whole range of factors, differing operating hours, inconsistent payment messaging practices, and complex compliance checks. Making use of the new NPP International Payment Service, which allows the final Australian dollar leg of inbound cross-border payments to be processed in near real time, should help here. There's also a range of ISO messaging initiatives where more progress is needed. Achieving international consistency in the data carried in payments messages will reduce the need for manual intervention by providers and therefore should increase the speed and lower the cost of transactions over time. A final word on cross-border payments. The RBA continues to participate in initiatives like Project Mandala, which is a collaboration with the BIS Innovation Hub. We'll hear a little more about that later today. And really what's in frame here is examining a common technical model for automating regulatory compliance processes in cross-border payments, including sanctions and AML CTF requirements, with a view to increasing the speed of compliance procedures and reducing the number of failed transactions. This leads me to another focus area for the bank and for the Payment System Board, which is shaping the future of money in Australia. A central element of this program is determining whether there is a public policy case to introduce a CBDC in Australia, and if so, in what form. We recently published a report with Treasury that provided an updated assessment of the case for a CBDC in Australia and outlined for the first time a 3-year roadmap for future work. Our current assessment is that the public interest case to issue a retail CBDC has yet to emerge in Australia. At the present time, we see the potential benefits of a retail CBDC as either modest or uncertain relative to the challenges it would likely introduce. That said, as the trade-offs evolve over time and as more international experience comes to light, the RBA and Treasury will continue to examine the issues. Now, like a number of central banks in advanced economies, we see the potential case for a wholesale CBDC as more promising, though not quite definitive at this point. A wholesale CBDC could have a key role in facilitating the settlement of transactions in tokenised asset markets and also in enhancing cross-border payments. This recognises the key role of central bank money in serving as the ultimate safe asset, particularly in systemically important markets, which is a point that's emphasised in international standards. We also believe that implementing a wholesale CBDC would be less disruptive and pose fewer policy challenges compared to issuing a retail CBDC. It would represent a more incremental change to existing arrangements where digital central bank money is already issued to eligible financial institutions in the form of exchange settlement account balances. That said, there's still some plenty of issues to unpack, and for that reason, we've made a strategic commitment to prioritise our applied research agenda over the next few years on innovations in wholesale digital money. That includes wholesale CBDC, but also private forms of digital money, like tokenised bank deposits and like stablecoins. Our most immediate priority here is launching a new project with the Digital Finance CRC, known as Project Acacia. Our focus here is on opportunities to uplift the efficiency, transparency, and resilience of wholesale markets through tokenised money assets and possibly new settlement infrastructure. We recently launched a consultation paper seeking industry feedback and inviting expressions of interest to collaborate with us at the bank and our partners at the DFCRC as part of this project. And so let me encourage anyone who's perhaps sitting on the fence, not quite sure, to reach out to our project team if you'd like to get involved. In addition to Project Acacia, we have a number of other CBDC initiatives in the frame over the next year. For instance, we're currently exploring options for engaging with the public to better understand their needs, their preferences and concerns relating to central bank digital currency. And we're planning to convene industry and academic advisory forums to provide more systematic engagement with external experts on a whole range of CBDC issues. In short, we've got an ambitious agenda on the future of money, but all of our efforts here are directed to ensuring that our future monetary arrangements are fit for purpose in the digital age. Let me conclude with a few words on cash. Clearly, cash use has declined over recent decades. We've seen that in Australia, we've seen that everywhere. But it does remain an important means of payment for many folks in the Australian community. A significant number of Australians still primarily rely on cash to participate in the economy, including our more vulnerable members of society. Cash also remains an important store of value, particularly during periods of economic uncertainty. We saw that most recently during COVID. We saw it also during the global financial crisis. And in serving as a backup means of payment when electronic payment systems are unavailable, Cash can also help to promote a more resilient payment system overall. When I travel internationally, I'm hearing more and more central banks talking about cash in exactly that light. And so for these reasons, the government and the RBA remain committed to supporting access to cash. There are, however, some challenges here. As cash use has declined, the cost of moving it around the country has increased. There's a significant effort to put cash in transit services on a more solid financial footing across the industry, but there's still considerable work to be done to develop a more sustainable long-term model for cash distribution in Australia. The challenge now for industry is to deliver more efficient cash distribution services while ensuring cash remains an affordable and viable means of payment for the Australians who wish to transact in it. So let me wrap up. Australians expect their payments to be convenient, reliable, and represent value for money. At the RBA and on the Payment System Board, we share these expectations. We want to see a payment system that is a hotbed of innovation and competitive tension, driving efficiency up and cost down. And we want to see a payment system that is safe and resilient, that is, one that Australians can rely on. As we contemplate what shape the payment system of the future might take, my colleagues and I at the RBA and on the Payment System Board are committed to working constructively with AusPayNet and with the wider payments industry. We are in this together. There's much to celebrate in the Australian payment system, but as I've made clear today, there's also a lot to do. On that note, I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that address. Very informative. We've got quite a few questions for you, but I have one just following up on your speech. You talked a lot about how much is going on at the moment in the payments industry. Can you give us a sense of the bank's approach to engaging with industry?
Yeah, for those that are perhaps newer to the payments landscape in Australia, we've taken an approach, almost like a philosophical approach, that's a little bit different from some of our counterparts internationally in that we try and engage. Our point of departure is always to engage as constructively as we can. We are not disposed to starting our conversations by reciting passages of legislation or by bringing armies of lawyers into the room. That's not how we try and engage. Our lived experience has been that the best public policy outcomes can often be achieved by speaking with industry in a way that gives them context and allows them to understand what the intent of a particular proposal might be. Now, that said, where those conversations are not leading to outcomes that we think are in the public interest, we will always reserve the right to invoke a national security concept, to bring out the hard power, to bring to bear the full range of our regulatory powers. But that's typically not where we try and start. And we found that to be, frankly, a useful guiding philosophy.
Okay, just pointing out that behind you, you can see the graphic recording of your speech. Can we just have it up again on the screen? Oh, it's disappeared now. Never mind. There it is. Have a look at it. Have you ever had one of your speeches transcribed that way?
I have not. No, that's a first.
Yeah, it's really amazing. It takes a bit of time to read into it, but so interesting. Okay, we're going to go to audience questions now. Thank you very much to everyone who has sent them in. Let's start with David Ross, a journalist with The Australian. Did the RBA fail to foresee the huge rise in scams and fraud when the NPP was introduced, and why didn't it push for a name check style technology at that time?
There's been, like, the rise of scams has been an issue that has been increasingly front and centre for the entire, I would say, for the entire official regulatory family. And the responsibilities on scams are dispersed across all of the regulators. I can assure you that all of the regulators that form the Council of Financial Regulators, Treasury, ASIC, APRA, ourselves,
and also the ACCC are very, very focused on this. There's a concerted effort to tackle this. It's taking multiple forms. The role that the bank has played in this has been to actively promote the development of mandatory codes. The bank has also been actively promoting safeguards like PayID over a long period of time. We are also engaging quite intensively with our counterparts at the ACCC, who've got the anti-scam centre set up there. So there's a huge amount of discussion, information exchange, idea generation happening across the entirety of the official family. And of course, we're engaging with banks and non-banks very frequently on all of the things that they're doing. So I want to assure everyone that the entire regulatory apparatus in Australia has a full court press on around this issue.
John Ryan from PayEd, are other solutions aside from NPP being considered for BEX replacement?
That's really a question for industry. We at the bank, the way that we see our role in this is not to be prescriptive about the end state. The decommissioning of BEX, the target date of 2030, was an industry-led initiative. Our role here is to ensure that as industry develops plans for future account-to-account payment system arrangements, that there's that process is done in a way that's really orderly and where the full ecosystem of participants have a voice in helping to shape that future. So that's really how we view that process. We've got a key role to make sure that the transition to whatever the future state that industry wants to coalesce toward, that is an orderly transition and that risks are being appropriately managed. We don't see our role to be highly prescriptive in telling industry what that future system, what the features of that system could be. We've also got a role, as I mentioned in my remarks, in engaging with a wide range of stakeholders and feeding back into forums like this some of the concerns and questions and issues that we hear to make sure that they get a good airing in these industry discussions about what the future system should look like.
Okay, I'm not sure who this question has come from, but why doesn't the RBA adopt the ECB regulatory framework? Is it time to learn from other mature markets?
That's a slightly tricky one. There's lots of different regulatory frameworks. It could be, is it in relation to digital assets or is it in relation to interchange?
We don't get the details in there.
Okay.
We can move on if you like.
Yeah, maybe it's safest to move on then.
Okay. What's the expected outages for NPP Pay 2 processing in 2025? How many hours downtime per quarter? That's very specific. Person says, thanks.
Yeah.
If you could just give us a heads up on that.
Yeah, that one's above my pay grade, unfortunately.
How do we as an industry help our customers make the move from the way they use BEX to NPP by 2030? Is this a bank-to-customer problem or something that industry has to address? Michael from NAB has asked that question.
Yeah, it's a really good question. What we understand is that there is now a very common understanding about the point of departure. Right, we're moving on from BEX. Okay. Industry's made that call. There is much less understanding across the entirety of the system, and by that I mean including the end users, about what the actual functional features of that future system should look like. We think it's really important that there's agreement sooner rather than later, that a consensus is able to be formed sooner rather than later on what the key principles, the key functional features of that future system should look like. Because once there is very clear understanding of the features that end users really value, then you can start to work backwards. You can start to build a roadmap that allows those, that creates a pathway, really, for those different features to be enabled and developed. I don't think it's helpful jumping straight to one potential solution without having very broad-based discussions with the entire landscape about what are the features that you most value in account-to-account payments, and how can we build on and uplift what we've already got. That's really the, we think, the foundational piece. That has to be industry-led. Now, the bank is happy to participate in roundtables, and I think Treasury also happy to participate in roundtables to help provide a perspective here or there, but industry's really got to grab the bull by the horns and make sure that they are engaging with the end users in the system and making sure that that their interests are being reflected in the development of the system of the future, or systems of the future.
For NPP coverage increase, does the RBA have plans or policy so that the same phone number can be used across more than one bank? If done, it will exponentially increase NPP coverage.
Sorry, could you repeat that one?
Does the RBA have plans or policy so that with these account transfers that the same phone number can be used across more than one bank? I guess that's to do with like PayID.
Yeah, if I can paraphrase or frame that question slightly differently, there are already mechanisms in place that that mean that a single phone number can give you a lot of functionality, and where PayID is an example of that, and we're supportive of that type of a efficient functionality continuing into the future.
Okay. The Australian markets close earlier than the major currencies, thus making it difficult to align liquidity and dates of when banks can support making payments. Are we able to extend Australian dollar trade windows?
I think, again, that's really that's a discussion that that we would welcome industry having. We know that from the international experience that alignment of operating hours is almost always going to be beneficial in terms of taking friction out of the system. We've seen operating hours be adjusted in other parts, for instance, of the Australian financial market infrastructure, and we think that that's been useful, so there's no reason why that same principle wouldn't apply more generally. But again, that's one where we would be looking for industry to lead on.
Right, okay. This next one speaks to that graph that you had up about the use of cash. And do we have any statistics as to whether the use of cash has increased at all by consumers who try to avoid the use of surcharge fees by retailers?
We don't, but we are about to launch, next year we'll be running the next iteration of our consumer payment survey. And that survey, historically, we've run every few years and gives us a real treasure trove of data in helping to understand how cash is being used and how different segments of the community are using it. We haven't fully ironed out the questionnaire yet. We try and maintain some level of consistency in the questions from one year to the next, but there's always scope to introduce new questions. And I think that really the subtext to that question is actually quite important, and it connects back to this broader piece of work that we've now undertaken in our review, which is to look really hard at surcharging, recognising that the era when the surcharging framework was put in place was very different, right? 20 years ago, the way that people transacted, engaged in the economy, was very different to the way that they do today. And our review is not one of those reviews where maybe the answer's sort of been cooked up, beforehand. This is genuinely a review where the bank has a very open mind about where we land. There's a whole bunch of issues are going to feature in that mix. We've already seen a number of responses which suggest to us that there are strong arguments on both sides. I can't give any steer now as to where we might land on that other than to say that every single submission that's been sent in will be given very close attention.
Because it is interesting to know the narrative that we've been reading about is that consumers are angry about those surcharge payments, but we've got a whole generation now, particularly, that are used to just paying electronically, and it would be interesting to know if that anger is strong enough to push people back to cash, or whether, you know, cash has just had its day for many of us.
Yeah, one of the things that we always try and communicate when we're talking about surcharging, and we realise it is a hot button issue and many consumers really don't like it, is to think about the entire surcharging in the context of a larger system. The propensity for merchants to surcharge will be lower if upstream costs are lower. So we have been very focused over the last two decades in pushing down the upstream costs, the wholesale costs. As those costs come down, our view would be that there would be, on average, less propensity for merchants to want a surcharge. Just focusing on the surcharge piece without reference to what else is happening in the ecosystem, we don't think would lead to good policy making. Ultimately, the costs in the system have to be borne by someone. They've got to be borne somewhere. So the consumer or the merchants or the card schemes or whoever. So we're looking at this issue in its entirety, not just sort of one piece of it.
Okay, we have 40 seconds left. One quick question. What is the RBA's view of the desirable qualities of digital currency?
Great question. I'll focus my response there on the wholesale side, because that's really where we see most cases. There's really two, I think, killer functions. One is it will potentially be able to do things that we can't currently do with central bank money. The programmability piece is a notable example. The second piece is around this concept called atomic settlement. What that means is conditional instantaneous settlement. Right now we have a system where you have asset trading going on one ledger, and then 2 days later on a completely different ledger, the settlement, the back end piece happens. Atomic settlement promises to cut through the T+2 world and bring the trading and the settlement onto potentially the same ledger, happening conditionally and instantaneously, and hence freeing up a lot of collateral and capital that's tied up for a couple of days in traditional settlement processes. So they're the two main sort of killer apps, if you like, of a wholesale CBDC, and hence we're really focused on the potential role that like tokenized asset markets could play in uplifting the efficiency, resilience of the Australian financial system.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we are out of time for more questions, but thank you for being such a good sport and taking all those questions, even the tricky ones. And thank you very much for giving our keynote speech.
Thank you. Thank you.